Thomas graduated with a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering from the University of Adelaide with first class honours. 4 years later, he received his doctorate in mechanical engineering also from the University of Adelaide. In 1977, he went to the United States to work for Lockheed Aeronautical Systems as a research scientist for Lockheed. He worked on fluid dynamic flows and aircraft drag. He later headed a research team that further examined a variety of aerodynamic and flight test problems. And he then worked on NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, where he could work more closely with the space program. In 1992, he was selected to join America's Astronaut Corps and completed training as a mission specialist the following year. 19th of May 1996 marked his first day in space, and he's had the opportunity to fly into space on 4 missions and become the first Australian in space. Dr. Thomas is speaking to us today on his flight experiences as an astronaut, and would you please join me in very warmly welcoming him to the stage.
It is a huge compliment to have been invited to give the Chapman Oration at this evening's event tonight. The theme, actually, before I go on, I especially should thank the Institution of Engineers Australia and the Victoria Division for sponsoring my trip. And I'd especially like to thank Eric Marinus, who works for the Victoria Division, I think is in the audience. She was the one that worked with me over the last several months to arrange the travel and everything. And I think she probably dreaded coming to work each morning, where she would find a litany of emails from me that I'd generated over the night from Houston of changing all the arrangements that she'd put so carefully in place. Thank you very much, Erica. I appreciate it. The theme of this conference is leadership, and I'm not really going to talk about leadership, although I would have to make the observation that the very existence of the space program owes itself to decisive and strong leadership. It began originally with President Kennedy's vision of going to the moon, and it was carried by a group of many very talented engineers who, through the 60s, 70s, and 80s and beyond, were able to pool the resources of a large country and do some amazing things. And there has been some amazing leadership at NASA. There have, I'm sorry to say, been some instances where that has not always been the case, so I may say a few words about that later on. But I'm not going to talk directly about leadership. I'm going to talk about my experiences as an astronaut flying in space. I've had the privilege to fly in space on 4 occasions, and it's been an amazing adventure, and I would like to tell you about those adventures. I'd like to give you a sense of what it's like to fly these missions, give you an understanding of some of the kinds of personal and human sensations you have when you fly into space and orbit the Earth. Of course, when you fly into space, it all begins with a launch. Launching on a shuttle has probably got to be the most extraordinary experience, I think, that anyone can possibly undergo. And I'm going to show you over the course of my talk tonight 3 separate sequences of shuttle launches from a viewpoint of someone who's experienced it. And each one will show you a different facet of it. I hope it gives you an idea of what it's like to ride this amazing vehicle. The first time I got to do it was 10 years ago for my first flight, STS-77. And of course, one always remembers the first time. It was an extraordinary experience for me. I have no idea why you're laughing. The sequence I'm about to show you is one of those launch sequences. And as you watch it, you will see in the top left-hand corner a small screen. And that's view that you would have if you were sitting in the shuttle looking out the window, and I think it's worth looking at. When you launch on the shuttle, you go out to the launch pad, you strap in, and you wait. You wait about 3 hours on the launch pad, listening to the countdown sequence. At 6 seconds before liftoff, the main engines are started, and you'll see that the engines are run up to full speed. They check what they call red line limits of the engines to make sure that they're working properly. If the engines are working properly, simply descent to fire the bolts that hold the whole assembly to the ground, the solid rocket boosters are ignited, and at that point, you are totally committed to flight. There is no turning back. And this is one such launch. Consuming fuel at a rate of about 12 tons a second, so it's not long before the solid rocket boosters are depleted and they're explosively separated from the whole assembly, which you see is a big flash of the pyrotechnics outside the window. At that point, you ride the main engines. The acceleration gradually increases to 3 Gs. Once it reaches 3 Gs, so we don't overstress the vehicle, we hold it at a 3 G acceleration. As you climb up through the upper parts of the atmosphere and out into space. As the fuel is depleted, you see flashes of plasma around the vehicle, then a big flash as the engines cut off. And at that point, you're about 250 miles above the Earth, traveling at a speed of 29,000 kilometers an hour, and it's taken you 8.5 minutes to do that. The first time I got to do this was on STS-77 in 1996, and after riding the vehicle into space, we immediately had to go to work and configure the vehicle to operate as a spacecraft in orbit. First thing you do is open the payload bay doors of the shuttle. The payload bay doors align with radiator panels, and they're essential for radiating the heat out into space, the metabolic heat and the heat from the electronics on board. And if you don't get them open, you actually have to do an emergency return to Earth because the vehicle will overheat and burn the electronics. And that's what you see here. In the foreground, that gold structure you see is the payload that we carried, which was, I'll say a few words about in a minute. One of the great moments for me on my first flight was my first view, of course, of Australia, which we saw naturally coming across the west coast, since that's the direction of our orbit. And that's what you see here. You see Sharks Bay in the left and Perth up in the upper right. The payload we carried, which I alluded to, was this satellite, and it carried on it this large structure made of mylar, which is actually an inflatable structure, which under computer control was deployed from the satellite and inflated with dry nitrogen gas. It's an inflatable antenna. This is a way of constructing a very large antenna in orbit using inflatable structures, and here you see it going through the inflation process. This was a technology demonstration, and really quite an important one. The advantage of this kind of technology is that it gives you the capability of carrying very, very large structures in a very small space. And this antenna structure, which you see its tripod legs developing there, was quite large. It was about the size of a tennis court. And you can imagine the difficulty of carrying something that large inside the payload bay of the shuttle, but because it was this inflatable structure, we were actually able to carry it with some ease. So this is a very important technology, I think, that future spacecraft can benefit from. That was the essential mission goals of the mission I flew in 1996. When I got back, I had the flavor of space flight, and I wanted to do it again, and I looked around at what was happening. At that time, the agency had made a commitment to send NASA astronauts to Russia to train to fly on the Russian Mir space station. So I thought, what an interesting opportunity that's going to be. Imagine going to Russia and training at the Gagarin Cosmonaut Training Center. So I signed up for it and went there in January 1997. You know, as a young child growing up in Adelaide, I had dreams of being an astronaut, but never in those wildest dreams did I ever imagine that I could train to become a cosmonaut. But that's actually what I got to do. And it was an extraordinary experience to do that because it was all in Russian. So I would go to these technical classes and an instructor would stand there and talk to me in Russian about what these complex spacecraft systems did. So I had to learn enough language to do that. But what actually made it worse was at the end of all of that training flow to make sure that I was ready for flight, they would put me in front of a panel of specialists and give me an oral exam on those systems in Russian. And I had to answer in Russian. It probably was the most intellectually demanding thing I've ever done as an astronaut, but I also have to say it was probably the most rewarding. I enjoyed the experience very much. After 1 year of training at the Star City Cosmonaut Training Center, I was ready for flight. I launched to go to the Russian Mir space station in January 1998. And here you see me in what we call the white room, which is the room at the top of the launch pad, where you're going to crawl in the hatch in the background there to go into the shuttle and launch. And you see I'm smiling, but that actually betrays to some extent my true feelings. It was a certain amount of trepidation because the space station Mir had gone through a lot of problems. There had been a depressurization on it, there had been a fire on it. But these are probably the two worst things that could have happened on any spacecraft. And I was going to go up and spend 4 or 5 months there. But we launched and rendezvoused with this spacecraft, which is actually, it was an amazing spacecraft. It was the Mir space station. It was 15 years old, but it was really a remarkably well-engineered visit, well-engineered machine. And I had a good visit on it. It was a great experience to spend time on that. I spent a total of 20 weeks on that vehicle. And the good thing about flying on a space station compared to a shuttle flight is it's a much more relaxed pace. It's a more normal routine. You know, you get up in the morning and you brush your teeth and you eat a meal and you have breakfast and you talk with your colleagues. And it's more like a 9-to-5 routine, whereas a shuttle flight is a very fast pace. It's just go, go, go the whole time. Here you see starting a typical day on the Mir space station. You see the sleeping bag, which you have bungeed down or velcroed down to the floor or to the ceiling or wherever you can find so that it won't float away. And it's very bad to wake up somewhere different from where you went to sleep. Despite the problems we had, and we did have two problems, we had a major loss of the guidance computer towards the end of the flight, which put us into a tumbling mode, which can be very dangerous because the attachments holding the vehicle together can actually fail catastrophically. We also had a fire on board, which was a very serious problem on any spacecraft, but we were able to deal with those. All in all, I'd have to say it was one of the very positive experiences of my life. As I mentioned, one of the good things about flying on a space station is that you have time to enjoy the experience, especially the view out the window. And there's a few views I'll show you here. This is Florida, of course, where I had launched on the shuttle. It'll zoom in towards the launch site at Cape Kennedy in January of 1998. This is a view of a more familiar landform, which many of you may recognize. It is actually Italy, but it's upside down in this perspective from what most of you see. This is a very personal one for me, of course. This is a view I got of South Australia in one orbital pass. You can see Kangaroo and the Gulfs, and of course Adelaide is in there. You also get to see some very interesting sights on the Earth from orbit. This is a meteor crater in Canada that's about 200 million years old, filled with ice. These forms look like clouds above the surface of the Earth. Actually, that is sea ice in the North Atlantic. You also see some of the deleterious effects of human presence on the planet, and this is some fires of the slash and burn farming in Central America that got completely out of control. And it was quite striking to see pools of smoke that would carry themselves over vast intercontinental distances from one country to another. Quite sobering to see that, actually. I remained on that Mir spacecraft for a period of 20 weeks, having launched in January. In June, it was time to come back. And I remember one morning in June, I looked out the window and I saw a point of light way off on the above the horizon, which drew closer. And it was the shuttle Discovery coming to get me. And I watched as it fired its thrusters and matched its PlayStation and came in closer, then as it got closer, slowed down its rate of approach, finally it met up with the near space station so that I could transfer from the air back onto the shuttle, then we could undock and deorbit and land, giving me 140 days in space, 2,250 orbits of the Earth, and 56 million miles total distance travel. That was quite an experience once I got back from it. I went through considerable rehabilitation, as you can probably imagine you have to do after a long flight like that. And then I was ready for another flight. That came later in 2001, and that was when I was assigned to STS-102 mission. This was my Space Odyssey 2001, if you like. This was a mission to the International Space Station. At that time, the space station had been flying for a few months, and it had a crew on board, and our mission was to go up and provide supplies to the space station, to do some assembly tasks on the space station, and to bring the crew back to actually do a crew exchange. So we launched, actually, in March of 2001 to the International Space Station, and I'll show you that launch sequence. Again, you will see a small... actually, this launch sequence, what you will see is firstly the launch sequence, as you saw previously, but then you'll see the view that a camera took looking straight out the window, and you'll hear some of the voice commentary of the crew on board, and you'll give you a sense, I think, of what it's like to actually light the rockets and ride into space on the shuttle. Engine start. Run up to speed and lift off. As we climb up, we roll to what we call a heads-down attitude over the ocean. Now, next scene, this is a view out the window. International Space Station as it was configured in 2001. It's grown a little bit since then, but with some more elements, which you'll see shortly. But this is the configuration it had. And so we flew to rendezvous and dock with this vehicle. Once we docked with it, we were given the task of doing some extensive transfer of cargo to the space station because we were a resupply mission. So we had several thousand pounds of goods and equipment on board that we transferred to the space station, and we bought several thousand pounds of used equipment and trash back with us. Moving equipment around in zero gravity is a unique experience because you have a lot more freedom to move things in zero G than you do on the ground. You can actually move things, large masses, in very innovative ways. But you can move very heavy, very massive pieces of equipment. Of course, they're weightless, but they do have mass. There's a lot of inertia. This wreck of equipment that my colleague is moving weighs something like 1,000 pounds, and you can see the relative ease with which it is moved. One of the great experiences for me on that flight was that we had to do some assembly tasks on the outside of the space station. And that required doing what we call an EVA, a spacewalk. And I was privileged enough to do one. Here you see me in the payload bay of the shuttle at the conclusion of that spacewalk. And I'm going to show you some video clips of what it's like to do a spacewalk and how you prepare for it. Of course, the first thing you have to do is don the spacesuit. You wear special thermal underwear, and then you don the spacesuit basically by putting the bottom part on. You put the pants on first, one leg at a time, and then you crawl up into the upper hard torso of the spacesuit, as you can see I'm doing there, and push your arms out through the arm openings of the suit itself. Then the two halves of the suit are mated together and locked together. see them doing there. You put on the communication cap.
You put on the gloves. You put on the helmet. You do leak checks to make sure that it's sealed properly. If it is, you close the hatches on the airlock
and seal it. Depressurize the airlock. Then you can open the external hatch and go out into the vacuum of space, as you can see I am doing here, coming out. And the first thing you have to do is tether to structure, because if you were to come free, it could be very serious. You don't want to do that, so you tether to structure. You remain tethered at all times.
Here you see me on the top of the robotic arm. As I said, we were a flight doing an assembly build on the space station, and that's what we're doing here. We're actually installing some components on the outside of the space station. It's actually a cable tray. Once we'd done that, we had to route the cables and route the cables down along the side of the space station itself, as you can see us doing in this view there. At the end of the spacewalk, I was asked to do an extra task, namely to climb all the way up to the top of this truss, which holds the solar arrays, hand over hand, to engage some latches which had not been properly engaged by the previous crew. And this, you see me going up to the top of this truss, and it was a pretty amazing experience to be at the top of the truss, 100 or more feet above the shuttle and 200 or more miles above the Earth. In fact, I can show you what that looks like, because many of you may know, when we do this, our helmets have small video cameras on them, and that video image is relayed into the shuttle and recorded. So if you were doing a spacewalk on the top of the space station trusses, this is what you would see. It really is a spectacular view. One of the great moments for me during this mission was doing this, and it was when the ground controllers called up and said, "Look down, you will see Australia." And I looked down, and I could see the continent of Australia passing between my feet. That flight was in 2001. After 2001, we continued shuttle flights on a fairly regular basis with every expectation that we were going to complete an early assembly of the space station on time, and things were looking good. Tragically, however, as many of you may know, in February of 2003, our progress was interrupted by what is arguably the worst human spaceflight tragedy in history, which was the loss of the space shuttle Columbia over Texas during its re-entry. That was a very disturbing day for us as astronauts, and a disturbing day for everyone who worked in the space program. This morning we heard General Cosgrove talk about leadership. When that event took place, many of us in the astronaut office were called upon to do things that we were not accustomed to doing. It was a very difficult day. I myself was responsible for staffing the Contingency Action Center, which we do for all launches and landings. I went in Saturday morning. I hadn't even shaved or showered because I expected I would go in, I'd sit there for 30 minutes, and I would be home in no time. I was still there 16 hours later. And we were given some daunting tasks. I was responsible to pull together some people to send them up to East Texas to try and find out what was happening. We were getting calls from law enforcement people saying that debris had fallen down and they didn't know what to do with it. We knew we had to send some personnel up there very quickly because some of this debris was propellant tanks, still containing propellant, and we knew it was a danger to the local population. But we also knew that seven of our colleagues had died that day. The debris from Columbia fell down on a ground track about 200 miles long and about 1 mile wide. We immediately started a search to recover that debris, and one of the most amazing experiences I've seen was the way many agencies of the federal government worked together to achieve this goal of finding all of this debris. We had thousands of volunteers who walked through the woods in northeast Texas and Louisiana, tagging all the debris that they could find and recording it and sending it back to the Cape for analysis. We recovered 80,000 pieces of debris from Columbia, representing about 40% of the dry weight of the vehicle. That was a pretty amazing accomplishment. All of that debris was taken to a hangar at the Kennedy Space Center for forensic analysis, where we used the debris plus analysis of the launch videos to determine the reason why Columbia had failed was due to a piece of foam which came off the external tank during its launch at such a high speed
that it impacted the leading edge and actually broke a hole in the leading edge of the shovel. Then during re-entry of the shovel, 2 weeks later, hot gases ingested into that wing, melted the structure and led to the breakup of the vehicle. In the weeks and years, I should say, that followed, a tremendous amount of work was done to re-engineer the tank to understand how debris, how foam came off the tank and to mitigate it so that it would not happen again. It was a very difficult engineering problem, as you can probably imagine. After some 2 years of that effort, the flight program was ready to resume, and a new flight was added to the manifest, which was the STS-114 mission, and I had the privilege to be assigned to that flight in late 2003. As you can probably imagine, a mission like that, the focus of the mission was to look at how to mitigate foam coming off the tank and to look at the sensitivity and the fragility of the thermal protection system, the tiles on the vehicle, and to understand the tank itself so that we could be assured that foam would not come off and damage the vehicle. In May of last year, the mission management team deemed that we were ready for flight, and a large tank, a new tank, was shipped to the Kennedy Space Center and wheeled into the assembly building, as you can see here, and mated to the Space Shuttle Discovery, as you can see here, being hoisted up in the assembly building to be mated with the tank and with the solid rocket boosters. Once those assemblies were mated together, and this is engineering on a large scale, I have to tell you, it was rolled out on the mobile launch platform out to the launch pad in preparation for launch. For us as a crew, we went down to the Cape in June of last year for a launch attempt, and actually we had to scrum for technical reasons, and finally we launched in late July. And it begins for us by donning the red or orange suits that we wear, and you see us wear during launch, as you can see us doing here in the same room where the Apollo astronauts actually checked out their suits. We then walked out the walkway to the bus to drive out to the launch pad with an armed guard escort on that long, lonely drive out to the launch pad to prepare for flight. When we got to the launch pad, we rode the elevator to the top of the launch tower, where we were greeted by the technicians who helped strap us in. Then one by one, we were called in to the vehicle to go in and get in our seats, which of course are on our back, and this will give you a sense of what it's like to do that. You haul yourself up with straps and wait through the count for the launch. And I'm going to show you the final launch sequence, which was the launch of STS-114 in July of last year. See the view in the corner is the view over the heads of the crew in the flight deck. There it gets done. It's wearing as it lurches back, holds fire, and you're on your way. If you're unfortunate to be riding the solid rockets, this is what you would see. And here, incidentally. At that point, you climb through the upper atmosphere at a Mach number of about 13. At the upper reaches of the atmosphere, you roll to a heads-up position, as you can see is happening here. Accelerate up to 3 Gs, burn off the fuel, and 8.5 minutes after the fuel is burned off, the engine's shut down. You see bursts of plasma around the vehicle associated with the hypersonic flight, and you separate from the tank, as you can see here. Fire thrusters to get away from it. Then the tank itself is actually deorbited and burns up in the atmosphere while we continue on in orbital flight. One of the things I had to do on that mission is, as soon as the engines decided to shut down, I had to unstrap myself, take off my helmet, my gloves, my parachute, and all the safety equipment, grab a large camera, and go to the window and photograph the external tank. The reason they wanted us to do this was to get photographs of the tank while it was still close to us to confirm that no foam had in fact come off the tank, to make sure that we hadn't been damaged. You can imagine then the concern we had when we looked at these pictures and we saw that not only had foam come off the tank, but a very large piece of foam had come off the tank. And needless to say, a lot of people got very excited by this. In fact, because we had so many cameras on board, we're actually able to film that. And this view shows the foam coming off the tank. It happened just after the solid rocket boost was separated from us. And you see it drifting off there. The good thing you see is even though it's a large piece of foam, it does not strike the orbiter. And this is just a repeat of it. You see the foam peeling off under the aerodynamic loads. As you can imagine, that was a source of great consternation to many people. So on the second flight day of the mission, we began a very extensive survey of the outside of the vehicle to make sure that it was safe. And to do that, I used this boom structure. This boom had cameras and sensors on it, which I swept over the leading edges of the wings, and in fact over most of the vehicle, to assess the tiles and to assess the carbon composite material on the leading edges to make sure that we had not suffered any damage. This is a view of the forebody. You see the thrusters in the forebody. You see the nose cap there. This is the hatchway. This is the same hatchway we crawled through just the day before on the launch pad to prepare for launch. And this is a global view of the shuttle. And you see the logistics module we carried in the payload bay to carry supplies to the space station. And, of course, the forebody of the shuttle itself. We completed a very detailed survey of large parts of the exterior of the shuttle. We had a lot of confidence that the vehicle had good integrity and would be able to do a good re-entry. At that point, we had to do a series of thruster fire-ons to catch up with the space station. And this is what it's like. You're in zero G, so any acceleration from a thruster is quite noticeable. This is the vehicle we're catching up with. This is the International Space Station, and you will notice that it's grown a bit from the previous pictures I showed because there had been some assembly done on it. That actually is a view over the Himalayas, as we're flying over the Himalayas. We flew close to that space station, and then when we were 600 feet below it, we did this, which is another first for the space shuttle program. We did what we call a pitch maneuver. We did a complete 360-degree pirouette beneath the space station so that the crew on board the space station could take photographs of the belly of the orbiter to make sure that the tiles, the fragile tiles on the belly of the orbiter, had not suffered any damage. And that's the maneuver that you see taking place there as we're actually flying over Eastern Europe. Once we did that, we came up behind the space station and fired the thrusters and approached it. Both vehicles have two docking rings on them, and these docking rings have latches. So as you bring the rings together, they latch together to hold the two vehicles and make the two vehicles. Then you clamp those two rings closely, tightly together. You check the pressure integrity, make sure you've got no leaks. If you have no leaks, you can then open the hatchways between the two vehicles and go through into the space station. And that's what you see us doing here. And the space station crew were very pleased to see us because we were the only visitors they'd had. And we were the first crew that had visited the space station over 2 years because of the Columbia accident. And one of the reasons I was very pleased to see us is we bought coffee for them. They'd run out of coffee. Believe me, you don't want to fly in space without coffee. And here you see Sergeant Krikalev, the commander, exchanging bread, a Russian custom for visitors at houses that you give them bread. We then did an assessment of the space station, and the sequence I'm going to show you now is what it's like to be in the space station. If you imagine you're holding a video camera, you're floating down the space station, this is what you see. It begins in the U.S. segment. And you're floating through towards the Russian segment. You'll notice there's an awful lot of equipment stored inside the space station in every nook and cranny. In fact, that's because it hadn't had a shuttle visit it in 2 years, and one of the tasks we had to do was bring a lot of that equipment back, which we were able to do. We've just passed from the U.S. segment into the Russian segment. This is called the functional cargo block, which is one of the elements of the Russian segment. Very reminiscent of the space station near to my way of thinking. And you'll see once again that there's a great deal of equipment stored in that module as well. Then we come through the adapter module that joins the two parts together into what's called the service module which is where the Russian thing is controlled from here. Also, very similar to the US, you may recall from the view I showed you. We remained docked to the space station for 8 days, and during that time we transferred a great deal of equipment to and from the space station, but we also did 3 spacewalks. During those spacewalks, we evaluated the techniques for repairing the shuttle as necessary. We also did essential repairs to the space station, and we carried some new equipment up to the space station because we were able to reinitiate and continue the assembly of the space station, which of course had been interrupted by the Columbia accident. After 8 days, we undocked from the space station, which is a reverse of the docking procedure I described previously. You close the hatches, you release the hooks, you fire the thrusters, and you back away, as you saw in that view there. We remained in orbit, expecting to come home to Florida within a day or so. Unfortunately, the weather, as is very often the case, was bad in Florida, so they waved us off and they gave us an extra day in orbit, which was actually kind of nice because we'd worked very hard to that point, and it was good to have a day off and to savor the experience of spaceflight. Of course, we didn't want to waste taxpayers' money, so we used the time as productively as possible. Here you see me studying the kinematics of rotating bodies. And this is our commander, Eileen Collins, showing a sleeping bag. This actually is how you sleep, essentially. She's hanging it up a bit. That's basically how you sleep. And this is a very novel approach to the use of a cyclo-odometer. This is the galley, actually. That's, you know, there where you see my crewmate is actually the galley. That's where we rehydrate food. And while they were rehydrating food, I played with my food. As you will see here, you've been able to do some really interesting things with liquids in zero gravity, I have to say. And as a former fluid dynamicist, this was great fun for me. So after our down day, we finally got approval to come into land. We actually had to land at Edwards Air Force Base in California because the weather in Florida remained bad. And that begins by donning the suits, these are the suits you have worn for the launch, but now you have to put them on in zero gravity. That's a big challenge, even in 1G. In zero gravity, it's quite a challenge to put them on. Made all the more worse by the fact that after you've been in space for about 2 weeks, your spine is actually extended about an inch, and the suit is very tight. And it's quite a flail to get into it. In order to re-enter the atmosphere, you fire the thrusters of the shuttle to slow it down, and you do that over the southern Indian Ocean, and that starts you on a gliding fall towards your landing site. You start that over Australia, and you head out over the Pacific. As you head out over the Pacific, you actually penetrate the atmosphere, and you're traveling at a speed of Mach 25. And of course, that's hypersonic velocity. The air around you dissociates completely, and as you look out the dark window, the air initially turns sort of purple, then pink, and red, and you see these big bursts of plasma out the overhead windows, as you can see here, as you leave this incredible plasma trail behind you coming into the atmosphere. If you look out the forward windows, you see bursts of green light and sparklets of green light around the red hot window frames as you come into the atmosphere. If you ever get to see one of these entries from the ground, it's an amazing sight. It is just like a meteor coming in. The vehicle is incandescent, and as it flies through the atmosphere, it leaves this pencil-thin trail following behind it as it streaks down towards the ground. Of course, it bleeds off speed as it comes in, and eventually a point is reached where it flies essentially as an aeroplane. It's slowly the crew take over manual control, and it flies aerodynamically. It is a glider, of course, but it's a very high-speed glider. At about 50,000 feet, you take full manual control, and as you approach the runway, you fly a large gliding turn, and you adjust the radius of the turn so that when you cross the threshold of the runway, you have the right speed and the right altitude, or more correctly, as we say, the right energy. And here you can see how guidance does that, lining up, having done that turn, lining up with the runway through the head-up display in the forward window. You're moving pretty fast. As you pass through about 2,000 feet, you do a pre-flare to slow the vehicle down and bleed off some of that speed, as you can see is about to happen here. Now, for the aviators in the audience, if you look at this, you'll realize this is a very steep glide. And you have to do it right the first time. There's no go-around capability. and no engine. At 500 feet, you do a final flare to bleed off more speed and to allow you to then deploy the landing gear so that you can cross the threshold with about 200 knots of speed and come down for touchdown on the runway, as you can see in this view here. Begins with main landing gear touchdown. Followed by nose gear touchdown. Because this is such a heavy vehicle and to save the brakes, we use the parachute to help decelerate us as we roll out down the runway for wheel stop. Once the vehicle is actually stopped, the crew transport vehicle comes up to us. Flight surgeons come on board. They help us get out of our suits. They do a medical check. And if all is well, we're able to come out and walk around the vehicle and see what shape it's in after the flight. And this is actually what we did. This was almost exactly a year ago, actually, in August of last year at Edwards Air Force Base when I completed the 114 mission. It was an extraordinary opportunity to be on that mission. It was certainly one of the most important missions I think has been flown. And it was a great thrill to do it. I consider myself extremely privileged to have had these experiences that I've described to you tonight, these four spaceflight experiences. A lot of people say to me, oh, you've been very lucky to do this, but of course, luck had nothing to do with it. You don't do these things by luck, you do it by a certain amount of tenacity. And in my case, education. Some people have asked me, what is the legacy of my time in human spaceflight and flying into space? I don't know if there will be a legacy. I hope there is. I hope there is some enduring legacy. And if there is, I hope it is that young people will look at what I've done, what I've been able to do, and realize that if you get the right education, you can really unlock doors to quite unimaginable possibilities, as I did. Thank you all very much.